Leave your fear of the unknown and leave the planet you call home. Leave all the thoughts you think you know. It's time to let them go.
Let it go.
Extend your hands towards the stars and dip your toes in the valley Mars. Celestial storm in my backyard, and the universe explodes. Let's see how fast our hearts can go. 'Cause you and I could be that comet in the sky. If we hold our breath, take a leap and close our eyes, we could fly. I believe if we try, we could fly.
Hi, you guys. This is Richard Sachs. I'm your host on Lost Arts Radio, and I'm glad to be with you again. Thanks for spending the time with us. We have a great guest tonight, courtesy of Doug, who is a friend of our guest, and this is L.A. Marzulli, that I've been interested in getting on the show for quite a while, and is the author of 12 interesting books, including On the Trail of the Nephilim, which I believe is two volumes, and is about the cover-up of the Nephilim, which are like appear to be giants mentioned in the Bible, and for some reason nobody wants to talk about them except LA and a few friends now, and might have some impact on our conception of history and a few other things.
No,
I'm just guessing now. It might, yeah. Maybe it wouldn't have any effect, but we'll see. We'll talk about that. So LA's a lecturer on the Nephilim and a lot of other interesting subjects, including UFOs and ancient prophetic texts. So we've got enough material here to do probably 20 hours of shows if we go fast. But we'll try to condense this down into a single unit that we can discuss and get your interest with. And he's also got a video series, which I was able to see the latest one of, and that's called, first I want to mention, in their own words, the UFOs are real. But the one that I was able to see was about the mound builders. And if we get a chance, it would be really nice to talk about that and the work that LA is doing now. So welcome to the show, and thanks for taking the time to be here. I appreciate it.
Well, great to be here. Thanks for having me on. Very cool.
Sure. So what I'd like to do, since these shows are generally designed to bring in people beyond the ones that already know what you're doing, you know, the ones who don't know what any of these things are, what's a Nephilim, what's a mound, you know, that sort of thing. So it's, I want to introduce you as a person so they feel like they're right in the living room with us talking about this stuff. We can go back to whatever time in the past you want that got you interested in pursuing this line of inquiry and kind of track it up to now, and then we'll get into what's happening now and whatever parts we can talk about.
Sure. I'm a student of the arcane. I've been delving into all this stuff since I was a kid. I mean, when I was 13, the Beatles came out, and that opened up the whole occult experience from Eastern mysticism, the hippie movement. I was at Woodstock and inhaled as deeply as I could. I had spirit guides. I was totally into Carlos Castaneda, the Yaqui way of knowledge. I did Silva Mind Control, and finally I wound up with Guru Maharaji for 3 years. And I meditated, I joined the ashram. That's like,
wow, really. Before we get too far along, I want to make sure everybody's following us. You said you're a student of the arcane. What's the arcane for people who have no idea about that?
Well, it's you could say esoteric texts. A different way of looking at the world, apart from, let's say, Judeo-Christian mainstream religion, and that's what I kind of did until I was 30. I was like a student of the arcane and the occult, and so my roots are there. And then it all switched when I was 30. I had sort of a Paul on the Road to Damascus experience, which was absolutely profound, and weighing it against everything I had just been through for the last 15, 18 years. It was mind-boggling, the difference between them.
Can you describe what happened during that experience and what brought it on?
I basically asked. There was a book I was reading by David Hunt. It was called, I think it's called The Cult Explosion. I always get the two titles confused. Okay. Kingdom of the Cults of a Cult Explosion. I'm reading this thing. Somebody gave it to me. I'm going, right. Yeah, I've tried that. Yeah, I've looked into that. Yeah, I know about that. Yeah, my third eye's open. Yeah, I've tested nectar and all this other stuff. And at the end, you know, the author, David Hunt, made a case that all those things are valid experiences in the sense that a person does experience them. I mean, when the Mahatma, who's that just means holy man, when the Mahatma opened up my third eye, I mean, I saw incredible light. That was a occult experience. There's no way that didn't happen. I mean, it happened. When he put his fingers in my ears, I heard celestial music. So all those experiences were real, astral projection. This was something different. And I've never been able to put it in terms, simple terms, but to try to do that, it's like all the things that I had done since my early youth till 30, never dealt with the core issue, which is man's depravity. It never dealt with that. It masked it over, you know, with experiences, but it never dealt with the core issue, my own depravity. And so when I accept,
and what do you mean by that, L.A.? What's depravity in your mind when you say that?
We lie, we steal, we cheat, we get angry, we yell, we give the middle salute to somebody on the freeway, we harbor resentment, bitterness, anger, hatred. I mean, the list is, you know, won't forgive this person, and that's our depravity. And you know, there's people that get sick because they're so bitter against stuff that happened 30 years ago that they never forgive. And so we're trapped in their own bitterness, and sometimes cancers and all sorts of other stuff can happen because of them. I'm not saying all disease is cause of that, but you can link a lot of stuff to it.
It has an effect on everything, yeah.
Yeah, so this was completely different, totally unexpected. And at the same time that this was happening, I was all of a sudden exposed to the entities that I had worshipped and let in, as it were. So it was 3 years of intense supernatural spiritual warfare.
And so what do you mean you were exposed to them? What happened that made you describe it that way?
All of a sudden, you know, my thoughts were not my own. And that I know can be incredibly strange to someone. And that's, you know, you need to get on Xanax and go see a psychiatrist.
Right. So do you mean like a feeling of possession or just influence from the outside or?
Yeah, I mean, not voice to skull. I never heard voices. Okay.
Okay. Like okay.
But what happened was thoughts would come in that were not my own, that I did not generate.
And they were horrible. Out of nowhere. Apparently.
Yeah. And they were horrible thoughts. Okay. And I didn't know how to stand up against that and push them out. I wasn't armed, and it took basically 3 years. It was like being in boot camp, and I finally learned how to do that. And there was a period of like 10 years between 30 and 40 where I became a worship leader at a church, and every time the church doors were open, I was there, and I was rooted and grounded in the biblical prophetic narrative. And the problem is that book literally is a sealed book. I mean this. It is a sealed book. You can read it till the cows come home and you won't understand it. The only way a person can understand it is when the Spirit of a Living God illuminates passages and opens it up. And it's been 39 years since I've been doing this. And I used to read like a couple of chapters a day or whatever. Now it's sometimes it's just a line, and I'll go on the internet and look for commentaries. It's incredibly complex and deep. And the bottom line is, it's got 66 books by 40 authors, and yet we see it's an integrated message system. That's a direct quote from one of my mentors, Chuck Missler. And these books were written sometimes one author, let's say, 2,000 years ago, didn't know the author. 1,000 years that predated him. And yet we see it's an integrated message system, which is ridiculous. And then we see the prophetic thread, which runs through Genesis to Revelation, and it really becomes mind-boggling.
So what you were doing is taking the apparent meaning, which you found out to not be accurate, and finding out what's the real meaning, right, over time.
Well, let me put it this way. There were certain things like Jesus walked on water. Okay, I get that. That's real simple. I understand that one. You know, that's not allegory. That's not metaphor. Jesus walked on water. He did it a bunch of times, by the way. So there's a saying I tell people, if you think you know him, but you don't know him, then you don't know him. And I didn't know him 39 years ago. I thought I knew him, but there was no personal relationship. And when I asked him in, and it was in the privacy of my own home, there was no one around, no one twisting my arm, no guy on television, nothing like that. I just said, look, if you're real, come into my life. I had hit bottom with everything. I just, what am I doing here type of thing? And when I asked him in, it was exactly the opposite of what I would have expected. Other people, when they've done that, have incredible, joyful. Mine wasn't like that. In other words, I was being pulled out of 15 to 18 years of being immersed in the occult. And I had what I would call kleons. I had entities that did not want me free, that wanted me kept in the bondage that I was in. So, I'll just give you an example of some, let's say, some scripture that you'll look at, or I'll look at and contemplate and wonder about. And when all of a sudden it's illumined and we see that there's dual meaning, or that there's several meanings, and that it's much deeper than just a casual glance. There's one scripture in Revelation, which is happen to be in the book of Revelation now. Don't ask me why, I just find myself there.
Sure.
But it talks about those who would say they are Jews but are not, and are the synagogue of Satan. That line is incredibly charged and has created all sorts of anti-Semitic diatribe and just pogroms and all sorts of nonsense for thousands of years, because it's been taken out of context. So when we look at that, you know, what the author John is talking about, that those who say they are Jews but are not, underline that, they are not Jews, but are a synagogue of Satan. So, but it's twisted, it's maligned, and the person can read that, and there are people on the internet that take that and make the case that these are not the Jews back in the Holy Land, let's say in Israel, which brings us to another prophecy that was written thousands of years ago that talks about, in the latter days, I will gather you, Israel, from the four corners of the earth and gather you back in your homeland, never, by the way, to be expunged or taken out of that, driven out of it again. So, you know, people can say, well, that's all manipulated and yada, 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 and study history, and we find that had Hitler won, there would be no Jew left on the planet. And at the end of World War II, the British were actually turning back the people from the Holocaust, so and sending them back to the camps. So it's not what people think it is. And when the Brits just pulled back, Israel was immediately attacked by all of her Arab nations. So, I mean, there's a lot of complexity here, and that's a three-hour conversation in itself. But that's just one prophecy, which that thread of prophecy runs, that's thousands of years old, 60 books, 40 different authors.
Okay, so maybe we can't do the three-hour conversation version right now, but the bottom line, can you say what you found out basically was the correct way to understand that part?
I would say that I'm still a student and still learning and will continue, but there is a way this is, first of all, it's a way of life. In fact, the early Christians called it the way. That's what Christianity was called. It was called the way. Now, it's been perverted in modernity. There are cults that call themselves the way. Nothing to do with it. So the way was penned and used by early Christians because all of a sudden people had the indwelling of the Spirit of a living God in them. And see, that's the difference between all this stuff. And there's three people that talk to me, okay, in my head. And let me explain that, because this can sound, you better get some Xanax, Marzulli.
Yeah, but, well, we're calling CPS to come pick you up,
exactly,
right now for your own protection.
I mean, I can think about the film I'm working on, episode 3. in the On the Trail of a Nephilim film series. I could think about the authors and the interviews, and I can use my brain to use that, you know, and I can think about that and hold, you know, multiple, like four-dimensional chess and how this is going to work with that. I can do all that. Okay. Then the dragon can come along and he can throw me something nasty or an idea that's not from me, but that's from him. And then the spirit of a living God can counter that with something. So there's three different voices, and this is all scriptural. And what a Christian learns to do is discern whose voice it is he's listening to. And of course, the dragon is incredibly subtle and can mask things in a lot of different ways. There's actually something I wrote that, and that's why he, back in the garden, when he's talking to Eve, the serpent, you know, the dragon, that's what it was. Eve's not afraid of him, which means, in my opinion, this is what I mean. You just take that one little deal. So Eve's talking of a serpent, right? Well, that's just pregnant with meaning because she's not afraid. She's not running from this, and she's not bouncing it off her husband. So it begs the question, was this their second encounter, their 50th encounter, their 200th encounter? We don't know. And why is
it? The lack of fear suggests familiarity is what you're saying, right?
Absolutely, all day long. And she dialogues with, and something else, she doesn't find it strange that this shining one is talking to her. She's not recoiling, goes, who are, she doesn't find it strange. So that whole scenario is really pregnant with a lot of things that we can look at, not sure exactly what, it doesn't give us the particulars, but we can certainly agree that there's more to that than what meets the eye. And that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about.
Okay, okay. And that was started when you were about 30?
Yeah, that's 39 years ago. I'll be 69 this year.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah. Okay, so what happened after? That was a while back. So what were the stages that started at that point?
Well, it was basically 10 years of study, of just study and walking it out, and marriage, two kids, and working for a living. And when I was 40, that's when everything started to change. And that's when the spirit of a living God basically said, okay, let's go back and examine everything you just went through, you know, 20 years ago. And okay. At first I was very reticent to do that. And that has led me, the book that changed my life was a book that was written by Dr. I.D.E. Thomas called The Omega Conspiracy, because it was part of the biblical prophetic narrative that made no sense. In fact, when I got there in my first read through, I almost threw the Bible against the wall and goes, well, this is stupid. This doesn't make any sense. Noah's flood is a huge one. Why destroy the earth for Noah's flood? Sodom and Gomorrah is another one, right? Then you get the most troubling one. You get when the Israelites go into Canaan, and there are these tribes there. And the God of the Old Testament, who, by the way, is the same God of the New Testament, but basically says, wipe them all out, men, women, children, kill the animals and burn everything. When I got to that, I just went, wait a minute. This doesn't sound right. I don't know whether I can do this anymore. And when I went and protested to my pastor at the time, he really didn't have an answer for me. However, when I read Dr. I.D.E. Thomas's book, The Omega Conspiracy, Dr. Thomas was a pioneer in regard to the Nephilim. That book changed my life, completely changed my life, set me on the course that I've been on ever since, and I've never looked back. And it's responsible for all the books I've written, all the ongoing research that we're doing, and, of course, the new film series, On the Trail of the Nephilim. And all of a sudden, all these ancient sites, which are hidden in plain sight, become something else than what the modern-day archaeologists and modern-day academics would tell us, in my opinion.
Okay, so if that book was that incredibly important to all your work since then, it probably is worth a few minutes to tell us what's in the book
that affected
you that much.
Yeah, you know. Dr. Thomas goes back into the Genesis 6 narrative, and what that means is he looks, first of all, he's a pastor, he's a theologian, Dr. I.D.E. Thomas, a guy, one of the smartest men I've ever been around, and he was a mentor. I received my honorary doctorate through him. And that was a red letter day for me. But he he talks about Genesis 6, and he looks at that, and he says, who were the sons of God? And this is a little lesson, and this is what I mean about Scripture being right there. But if you don't know who the sons of God are, then you don't know who the sons of God are. And that's why it takes digging to find out who they were. The Hebrew is B'nai Ha-Elohim, which refers to the fallen angels. That's what it refers to, or the angelic host. The book of Enoch, which is a pseudepigraphical book, meaning written by someone else, but attributed to Enoch, basically tells us that the angels of heaven saw the daughters of men and lusted after them and had sex with them and created this progeny known as the Nephilim.
So the Hebrew was fallen angels, right? Literal translation.
Literal translation is the angelic host. Doesn't tell you who it was, but it's the angels of heaven. So obviously we're not the good guys.
Yeah, and then somebody translated that into sons of God?
Well, it's the B'nai Ha-Elohim, that's the Hebrew, which means sons of God, which refers to the angelic host. That's what it refers to.
Okay, sorry.
So, that's all right.
So where does that lead? I mean, the book says that much. Where does it go from there?
Well, there's a scripture that unless a person understands Genesis 3:15, and these are just addresses. It'd be like I say, you know, chapter 10 and Moby Dick. You'd go to chapter 10, and we would talk about chapter 10. That's all it is. It's just an address. Yeah. So when you go to this book, Genesis Beginnings, 3:15, there's a statement which I believe is the overarching statement of the rest of the entire Bible. Everything is based on this, and I'll tell you what it is. There are several people in the scene. The dragon is there, Adam and Eve are there, and I believe the pre-incarnate Christ is there, Messiah, Jesus is there, okay? And he says something, they've already blown it, they've eaten the fruit, yada, yada, yada. They realize they're naked, the whole deal. And our Creator God, Jesus, says to the dragon, your seed, this is what's critical, your seed, the seed of a dragon, will be at enmity, at war, with the seed of the woman. I'll say it again. Your seed, your offspring, will be at war, at enmity with the seed, the offspring of the woman. He, someone is coming from the offspring of the woman, will crush your head. You, the dragon, will bruise his heel. That scripture is so pregnant with meaning and literally sets up the rest of the prophetic narrative. And unless we come to an understanding that it is literally a seed war between the seed of a dragon, the offspring of the dragon, and the offspring of the woman. Thousands of years later, the offspring of the woman incarnates, as for Christians, we believe, the Messiah, the Mashiach. Three chapters later, the seed, the offspring of the dragon, in the form of the fallen angels, descend on Mount Hermon, take the women, and begin to procreate. And the reason for the flood is, this is not a weekend frat party. This goes on for perhaps 400 to 500 years. We don't know specifically how long it goes on for, but it goes on for a long time. And only 8 people were saved. Why are the 8 people saved? Because everybody else has been contaminated. Either they've given themselves over to this occult paradigm, or they're half-breed. They're Nephilim. Their DNA has been mixed. And so the purpose of the dragon doing this is to thwart the prophecy that we read in Genesis 3:15. Someone will come to crush your head. The dragon knows all he has to do is stop the seed of the woman, corrupt the seed of the woman, corrupt the DNA, which is what he tries to do. And that's graphic. And that results in the flood. And then after that, every other time we see this war, that's what he tries to do. And when we finally get up to where the Israelites go into Canaan, what we find there are the Nephilim tribes. The Nephilim, the Zanzumim, the Raphaim, the Anakim. They are there in the promised land, and they're there for one reason. Once again, to stop the seed where the Messiah will come from, the one who will crush the dragon's head. So what this means is we are at war. And this is why the planet is the way it is. We are literally in this cosmic war. I've written a book called A Cosmic Chess Match, which illustrates this and talks about all this. So it's people can choose to believe it or not, but the whole idea of being on the trail is from the idea that when the Israelites go into Canaan, there was a diaspora of the giants, of the tribes. And not all of them are giants, we feel. Like Anakim, which is one of the Nephilim tribes, means long necks. And this ties into our research in Paracas, Peru, where we realized that because of the placement of the foramen magnum, where the spinal column attaches to the bottom of the skull, It's different. It's shifted all the way back. And this is the work of our good friend and our anthropologist, archaeologist on the team, Rick Woodward. It was his discovery. He was the one that put that together. Nobody else did. Other people may say that they did, but he was the one that wrote the paper. He was the one that discovered it, and which is incredible. And then our team, Mondo Gonzalez, Rick Woodward, Chase Klotsky, Richard Shaw, and others that came on. We were the one. I raised the money. We did the DNA testing. It wasn't complete. We never got nuclear DNA. We got lots of mitochondrial DNA, which showed, and in my opinion, without a shadow of a doubt, that these whoever these people were, they originated from the Middle East and Europe. And that rewrites history. Of course, immediately we were chastened by academics and the professional skeptics. But I kept saying, go do your own research. You go down, you get 58 samples, you test them. You wear the suits, you use two different labs, and here's the results. Show us where we're going wrong. And not only that, when they attack the DNA evidence and they call it contamination, even though our protocols in the field were stringent, and we had one person write us and said that, wow, your protocols to collect the DNA were above industry standards, and they were. I mean, we absolutely went overboard. Labs, full-on lab suits. We changed the lab suits every time a new specimen was brought in. Double gloves, face masks, hair nets, boots. And Mondo, we had our DNA tested, so we knew that we weren't contaminating anything. So, I mean, right. These people, the reason why they don't like it is because it goes against the existing paradigm in academia. That's sure. why they don't like it. But that's what we found.
Yeah. Those are generally the biggest enemies of science is the scientific establishment, usually.
Sure, usually, right.
So what geographical place, again, were you collecting these specimens from?
We went down to Paracas, Peru, and Ica, I-C-A, Ica, Peru. And okay. We collected the specimens from there with the authority or from with the authority of the Peruvian government. It took 3 years and tens of thousands of dollars to get that permit. Not to mention that Mondo Gonzalez, as one of our archaeologists on the team, wrote the paper and presented it, and that's why we got it through. So okay. You know, I came out of Peru with a bag full of samples, and that was when we collected the samples, we had to give them to their archaeologists, and then 3 months later, they had approved it. We had to fly back down to Peru, and that's $10,000 to get a team. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. Okay.
So the samples are DNA samples or pieces of what, bone Correct. Or something that from which you could extract DNA and analyze it. And Correct. These were from skeletons that were big skeletons, like unusually big, like what you could call giants, right?
No, they were not giants. That was so interesting. We think that they, and Anakim. In other words, because
they have the big skulls.
Yeah, the elongated skull like this.
Okay.
And there were morphological differences, structural differences within the skulls themselves, which had to have been genetic. And this gets technical, like the foramen ovales are missing in many of the Paracas skulls. The ovales are right up in here. Obviously I can't touch them, but they're inside the skull in front of the foramen magnum, where that's where the skeleton or the spinal column attaches to the base of the skull. Well, the foramen ovales is where all the nerve endings and blood vessels go in and allow us to make facial expressions that we make. Well, the Paracas skulls, many of them do not have foramen ovales. The foramen condyles are different size. I mean, everything. The foramen magnum itself is smaller and pushed all the way to the rear of the skull. And you cannot use cranial deformation where you wrap a child and mold the head or cradle headboarding to do this.
It doesn't work. Yeah. So you were interested in these because they were human-type skeletons, but there were enough differences of these certain kinds that you suspected this might be later examples descended from the original Nephilim. Is that right?
And this is This is conjecture on our part. That's our hypothesis.
What made you think there might be that connection?
Basically, because they were unlike any other Peruvian people that were there. They show up on the Paracas coast about 3,500 years ago, which fits the timeline perfectly for the expulsion of a diaspora of people leaving the Levant, fleeing the Levant. And they show up there. They have technology, which indigenous people didn't have. And the DNA proved our hypothesis that the haplogroups were European and Middle Eastern. It's not supposed to be there, Richard. That rewrites history.
So they had a way to travel between continents, basically, right?
Basically, yeah. I also reference Thor Heyerdahl, who proved with Kon-Tiki and Ra, specifically Ra. He built a papyrus boat, and he sailed out the Straits of Gibraltar without a compass, just with a sail. Without knowing where he's going, he winds up in Barbados, which is the New World. So it could be done. Thor Heyerdahl proved it. We believe it was done in antiquity. And what's interesting is the Paracas people just vanish. They just vanish. And no one knows what happened to them.
Okay. So, and if I understand all that you're saying about the Nephilim, they're basically the foundational bad guys, the ultra enemy of humanity. Is that accurate?
That's on some level, that would be, you know, I wouldn't say the ultra, the fallen angels, the dragon, are the ultimate bad guys. But the Nephilim are certainly their bondservants, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, if they're not that tightly connected, what is the connection between the dragon and the Nephilim?
Well, the dragon, the offspring of a dragon, that's what we're looking at. The seed of a serpent.
That is the Nephilim.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're kind of descendants of the dragon.
Correct.
And the dragon was the one that was in messing things up in the Garden of Eden story, right?
Correct.
So that's why I say maybe that's the ultimate enemy of humanity then and now. I mean, who else would be more important?
You know, in some ways, I you know, to your point, I tie all this into, and so did my mentor, Dr. I.D.E. Thomas. We tie it back into the UFO abduction and so-called breeding program, which Dr. David Jacobs has talked about and others. Uh-huh. We have accounts of people who have seen hybrids and had encounters with hybrids. We've had people that have had encounters with black-eyed kids. We filmed that in our Watchers series. So, you know, not an actual encounter, but, you know, people who had the encounter and came on the record and talked about it. So what happened in antiquity is happening in modernity, only has changed. And this ties back once again into the biblical prophetic narrative from another book, another guy called Daniel. So from Genesis to Daniel are thousands of years. There's no collusion between the two. They didn't know each other. The writer of Genesis had no way of knowing that Daniel thousands of years later. It's impossible. And yet we see the integrated message system, as Missler likes to say. The prophecy in Daniel says that their seed, there's that seed thing again, their seed will mingle with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to them. And it's talking about the latter days, the end times, which in my opinion hails or points us right to the entire abduction scenario, where we see the mingling of seed, but there's the word cleave in the Hebrew is the same word that we get for marriage. So in Genesis, there was a marriage. They took wives and they married them in the Genesis account thousands of years ago and afterwards. But in the Daniel account, which happens, and now he's pointing. So Daniel's here in the timeline. Let me do this so you can see, get a visual. So Daniel's here. Moses is writing way back here. But Daniel is pointing here. Something at the very last, he says, in the last days, men will run to and fro over the face of the earth and knowledge will increase. That's prophecy. Men will run to and fro over the face of the earth and knowledge will increase. Welcome to the modern world. Then he talks about their seed will mingle with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to them. So again, that's a very cryptic passage. What are you talking about here? So unless we understand Genesis 3:15, we don't understand Genesis 6. We get to Sodom and Gomorrah, we're clueless. When we get to Israel and the conquest of Canaan, we don't know what's going on. And we finally get to Daniel, we go, who knows what he's talking about? And this is why it's deep and it's connected.
Okay, so in that last section about the Nephilim,
right,
how close to the present does that bring us in your journey through the whole thing?
Well, we did carbon dating, carbon 14 dating on several of the skulls. One was 1,935 years old. We actually unwrapped the baby mummy skull at Senior Juan's Museum. So that turned out to be 1,935 years old. Another skull, which we call the La Arroyo skull, which was given to us by a private collector up in Oregon, that showed 835 years old. But where it goes off the rails is when you get to the work of Steve Quayle, who broke the story on Coast to Coast about the Afghan giant in Kandahar and how the giant was flown out in a very large plane, and the pilot came on Coast to Coast, and Steve Quayle and George Norrie all talked about this. Well, fast forward several years later, we found a guy who allegedly said he was a shooter. He shot one of these things with a group of people that were on patrol, army guys that were on patrol. And we talked to him, and we also talked to Steve Quayle about it. And we had Steve, and Steve set this up. Steve got his shooter, or his airplane pilot with our shooter, and they talked. And that was really interesting. And at that point, we realized there were two. The one that our guy shot was over 12 feet tall. Six fingers, double rows of teeth, red hair, stunk to high heaven. The stench was unbearable, like rotted flesh.
So what? When you say your guy shot, you're talking about shot with a rifle or with a camera or what?
No.
What kind of shooting?
The backstory is this. There's a patrol in around 2001 that's looking for high-value targets in the Kandahar province of Afghanistan. This is, by the way, it's all in our Watchers 10 film.
Okay.
And so this patrol goes missing. They miss their rally points. They don't call in. They don't check in. So, you know, Central Command is concerned. And the next morning, they dispatch a helicopter roughly to the same landing place. And the new patrol begins to follow the footsteps of the old patrol. And they're coming down this goat trail, which then opens up on this like a ledge of a cliff. But it's about 30 feet wide and maybe 50 yards long. It's kind of an area on this cliff, and above it is a cave. And they're seeing bits of radio, bloodied bone. They're not sure what they're looking at. Is it like an ambush, wild animals? They don't know what they're looking at. All of a sudden, out of the cave comes this 12-footer brandishing a spear and a shield. And everybody is literally frozen, according to the shooter. They were just like dumbstruck, frozen, because you're not prepared for anything like this. And one of the guys, this guy by the name of Dan, broke out of his stupor and started running at the giant, firing his weapon at the giant. The giant moves with such agility that they were all taken aback. And before anyone could do anything, the giant has taken his spear and impaled Dan and held him up in front of the others. At this point, either the shooter, our guy who comes on the record, or someone else basically says, shoot him in the head, shoot him in the head. Everybody else, the gunfire lasts about 20, 25. This whole thing lasts about 30 seconds. From the moment they see it, so they bring it down. It happens very quickly, about 30 seconds. And they basically blow, basically decapitated, almost decapitated. The thing falls to the ground. Dan's still alive. They call a medevac. Dan succumbs to his wounds. And they fly the giant out in a C, whatever that is, C-137. I forget what it's called. And then they're told to give their account of what happened. And they were told to rewrite their report. What's interesting is we've had other people from the Kandahar province in latter years talk about the Kandahar giant. How'd you know about that? I've had people come up to my table that were stationed in Kandahar. The whole base knew you weren't supposed to talk about it. I was contacted by a guy, a goon from a deep state in 2016, and threatened. This is before right after the actually before the election. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it all went away when Trump got elected. But I was threatened by the deep state, and I was told the reason why I'm here is because your work on Kandahar. They don't want that out. I was contacted by another guy who's gone dark on me. He told me that there was a group in Washington that call themselves, that are, you know, part of military, deep state stuff, whatever. They call themselves Operation Titans. And when these giants are found and killed, the bodies are shipped to this group and they process them for scientific whatever. So, I mean, this stuff is, and you say, well, why don't they tell you? Because it points back to the validity of the biblical prophetic narrative. And they don't like that. They want to keep as many people dumbed down and unaware of what's really going on.
So I think you're also saying there's a connection between the 12-foot person who came out of the cave with the spear and a shield that I guess they made somehow. A connection between that guy. Oh, by the way, did it have clothes on or not?
Yeah, it did. It had some kind of clothing on it. And we see the thing is, we don't know how old it is. Is it 500 years old? Is it 100 years old? 1,000 years old? 2,000 years old? We don't know. They told me, the shooter told me that the stench from this thing was, it was enough to make you gag, or enough to make you vomit. That's how bad. Unlike anything he's ever smelled. The closest thing, he said it smelled like a rotted corpse. Not that I've smelled a rotted corpse recently. So right. I don't even know what that smells like. But that's when you, what he said.
When you say you don't know how old it was, you mean this particular being that came out of the cave could have had a very long lifespan.
Exactly.
Okay, and what's the connection between that and the totally different appearing skeletons that were in South America?
They are, the dragon is messing with the human genome, trying to create man in his own image. And that's
and
why
it's not working out very well.
It's not working out. Everything from giants. Are you aware there's a graveyard up in Ohio? And I've been there. It's unmarked, of course, but it's a graveyard. It's a field. And apparently, allegedly, there are giants that are there buried right next to dwarves. How's that work? A whole race of dwarves. And this was uncovered, you know, about 150 years ago. So, look, the bottom line is, when you talk to a modern-day archaeologist, all they're doing is spewing back the party line, what they learned in school, what they were told.
Every field is becoming like that, yeah.
Exactly what it is. So they just, there's not a lot of critical thinking. In other words, every time they find a 28 or a 30-pound axe head, oh, it's ceremonial. How do you know that?
Right, they used five people to pick it up anyway.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So I guess the idea is that the Nephilim right now would not have a uniform appearance necessarily, right?
We don't know. We don't know. The fact that there are so many different tribes of them in the Promised Land, in the Levant, when Joshua and Caleb go in there to conquer them, the Zanzumim, the Emims, the Rephaim, the Anakim, the Nephilim, to name a few, it's complex. And we don't have all the answers. We know from the first century historian Josephus that the bones of the Nephilim were openly on display as of his writing, which is the first century. So we know something's up. Right. But we don't know what they look like. They were giants. We know that they were giants.
So how would you characterize what it is you're trying to find out?
Well, for instance, in the films, The Mysterious Mound Builders, and then the new film, which is about to be released, and a shout out to your producer, Doug Diamond, because he mixes all of our sound and does a really good job of it.
Yeah, he's great.
But the Mysterious Mound Builders, we talk about the idea that, let's say, one of these mounds, just one, is Poverty Point, 390,000 tons of earth.
And where are those located?
Well, Poverty Point is in Louisiana, and I've been there.
Right, but I mean, are the mounds just in the U.S.? Are they all over the world? Or
there's a mound culture that was here. There's mounds and dolmens throughout Europe. It's everywhere. It's global.
All right. So, and what's a mound? What does it look like?
Well, the mounds can be small, that can be, let's say, 30 feet or 20 feet in diameter, to much larger ones, 1,200 feet in diameter. Or Cahokia, which is the largest mound in the Americas, and that thing is absolutely humongous, well over 450,000 tons of earth. So our team, and again, this is Rick Woodward, we asked the archaeologist at Poverty Point, Louisiana. We said, well, you got 390,000 tons of earth. How is this done? And of course, he tells us the party line. Well, they had baskets, deer hide baskets or birch bark baskets, and they used these hoes out of flint, and they dug by hand and moved all this dirt.
And they were very patient, right? This is like the soil analog of the stone pyramids, right?
This is wacky, is what it is. And so I asked the guy.
But these are massive structures, and instead of stone, they're made out of earth.
Correct.
But they've stood there somehow without washing away.
How does that work?
For a long time. Yeah.
For a long time. And what's interesting is, I said, well, how many hoes have you found here? And he said, oh, about 25. And I said, well, don't you find that incredibly odd that you only, with all this dirt, only 25 hoes? Surely there'd be an infrastructure. See, in all these places, there's no burial. So they say it took 300 years to build Cahokia. But then they actually do pollen testing, and they realize, wait a minute, it happened in less than two decades. So we've got a real problem. But what we did is we hired a flint knapper. This guy makes museum replicas, or replicas of these ancient hoes for museums. So we hired this guy. He creates this beautiful flint hoe with a nice little handle, and we hired a fit laborer. And we said, okay, we saw on film, and he goes out, and he starts digging with this thing. And what we discovered is, when we timed it and looked at it, based on the amount of weight, it's 26 million single buckets of earth to build Poverty Point. That's just one mound. There are 10,000 mounds in Ohio alone, and those mounds stretch all the way down from Ohio all the way down to the Mississippi, or out down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. So something else is going on. You don't have the manpower. You don't have the infrastructure. How did they compact the soil? And the Adena mounds are like this. The sides are really steep. We talk about this in the second film. But the second film, you know, puts the coup de grace on it, in the sense that there's mathematics, high mathematics, geometry, trigonometry, surveying techniques. Many of these complexes are built on an 18.5-year lunar cycle. And Native Americans from Maine to California state on the record, we didn't do this. We didn't do this. So mainstream archaeologists, this is the prevailing paradigm that's taught in the schools. Okay, so Native Americans built the mounds, but they just forgot that they did so. They just forgot that they actually built the mounds. Well, selective amnesia. Oh, gee, we have this oral tradition that goes back thousands of years and talks about Turtle Island, but and talks about us fighting the redheaded, cannibalistic, sadistically, you know, sexual giants that were here in Milan. We have that, but somehow we forgot that we built the mounds. It's nonsense. It's just nonsense.
Right. So are you saying that whoever built the mounds was another of many manifestations of the descendants of the Nephilim?
I call it Nephilim architecture, fallen angel technology. That's what I call it. And the fact that academia refuses to look at this, and we drilled into this in the second film. When you look at the relationship of the Newark earthworks between Geller Hill, the Octagon Mound, and the Circle Mound, the center of those points, and they're about a mile apart, over a mile apart from each other.
Right.
And the lines are dead straight. They form a perfect isosceles triangle.
Sides being equal, right?
Yeah. There are advanced trigonometry, and you can only see this from the air. Who is the prince of the power of the air? That's one of the titles of the dragon. Who is the prince of the power of the air? And I mean, there's other stuff we're going to be filming, and I'm working on number three now. The supernatural implications of the mounds. The Mayan elders went to the Serpent Mound. Why did they go there with the crystal skulls? What is it that they know that the average archaeologist has no idea? These were gateways. These were portals, and what they're trying, and they're highly charged places, but they're charged with the demonic. They're charged not with the good guys. That's why it's a serpent. And that serpent, by the way, in the Great Serpent Mound, is in the act of swallowing an egg, which once again goes back to Genesis 3:15. That's our research. We're the first people on the planet to actually put forth a new paradigm for the Great Serpent Mound. And of course, you know, oh, whoa, we can't have that, because they don't want to hear that. But that's exactly what it is.
So you're saying the Serpent Mound, the mound where the Serpent Mound is kind of the same shape as the other mounds, right?
No, the Serpent Mound is the largest serpent effigy on the planet. It's this serpent which undulates over this peninsula of rock, but that's a high place that overlooks a waterway.
The Serpent Mound's kind of an undulating ridge.
No, it's an undulating earthwork, and it's an effigy. It's an undulating.
Well, I mean, a fake ridge that they built out of earth, but that's the shape of it.
No,
I'm trying to picture it.
Got it. So there's a ridge which goes out like this, like a peninsula, natural stone, okay?
Yeah.
And there were caves underneath it. On top of that ridge is an undulating serpent made of earth, which moves over the terrain. And you can't see it unless you're in the air. In fact, they all know that, so they built a three-story tower on the site. And even on the top of the tower, which I've been a bunch of times, there's the tail. Here's the body, but I really can't see the head that well. Not sure what this is. We flew a drone a couple hundred feet up. It's just phenomenal what you actually get to see. And it's a serpent in the act of swallowing the egg. Genesis 3:15. The seed of a serpent will be at war with the seed of the woman. And it screamed. No one's ever discovered that. No one's ever said that. Well, New Agers will say, well, the serpent is wisdom, and it's giving birth to wisdom to mankind. Well, isn't that nice? Why is it always a serpent? And the serpent will give you wisdom. There's no doubt about it. But the price of that wisdom, as every shaman knows, is your soul. That's the price. That's what you pay for it.
So, and when you say these sites are all charged, is that something that you measured with instruments?
We have in some cases, yeah. And that's in the third episode, where we've actually had a paranormal group come in with us, and the temperature went from 82 degrees to minus 4. How is that possible? So, yeah, they are there. There's all sorts of nonsense. We have a friend, Henry Gruber, who was on the Serpent Mound, and he was doing what's called a prayer walk, but he wasn't told to do the prayer walk there. Wasn't told to go. In other words, the voice in his head, the good voice, didn't say do that. He just went on his own because he was there, and he figured, well, I just do this. So he struck down on the Serpent Mound, literally. He's in a fetal position. He can't move. He's paralyzed. He's just, his body is like cramped. All of a sudden, a snowstorm comes out of nowhere and starts snowing like cats and dogs. And he starts praying like, okay, you know, what's going on here? He crawls off the mound and crawls back into his van. And that'll be in episode 3, that whole story. These are highly charged ritualistic sites. Many of them engage in human sacrifice. And the blood is what charged all these sites. And there's a connectivity between the earth and between the sky gods. And when you open those gates and those portals, you open, just like the Tower of Babel, just like Hunbat's man and the 13 skulls and all the Mayan elders, what they were doing was trying to recharge these areas and open up the gateways. And the fact that no one knew that, and no one talked against it or said, what are you guys doing, or warred against it, is incredibly telling. They know what they are. They know exactly what they are, and that's why they went there.
Okay, and then when you look at the connection or the similarities and differences between the beings that were at the mounds and the guy in Afghanistan that came out of the cave, who obviously didn't have much technology, right? He was able to build a spear and some clothes and a shield. Is that just experiments? Is that one didn't work and the guy didn't know how to invent any advanced technology and the other ones did? Or what's the reason for the radical variability there?
And this is something that we're working on. When you go down the Sacsayhuaman in Peru, okay, you see what I would call pre-flood stonework, which we're looking at 80, 100-ton stones with polygonal shapes And, you know, I'm not the first guy to write about this. I mean, Graham Hancock wrote about it years ago. What's his face? Zechariah Sitchin wrote about it. Who's the guy that starts up Ancient Aliens? Why can't I think of his name? Anyway, not George Tsoukalos, but Tsoukalos is under him. He's the guy. Chariots of the Gods, Von Daniken. So Von Daniken, Von Daniken was there like 40 years ago. Von Daniken or whatever, that book changed my life. Chariots of the Gods. I read about it and went, yes, you know, UFOs, that's exactly what it was. I get it. But when you go there and you look at the polygonal stonework at Cusco, and you know, there's no beast of burden to move the stones, and all of these things are cut absolutely with precision. Whoever did it took their tools with them. So we don't have all the answers. That's why we're on the trail, quite honestly, Richard. We don't have all the answers. And it's a good point. Why is it that we have a 12-foot giant that's got a goofy spear and a shield? But the guy moves with such agility, and he's got superhuman. And the other thing is this. When they looked at the body, what they saw, what appeared to be bullet holes that were in the process of healing on the giant.
So some things about him were advanced.
Very advanced.
Just not the technological ability to fabricate things.
Right. But then we get into, let me just jump into the modern day UFO phenomenon.
Right.
Where we have UFOs and all of a sudden people are having Bigfoot encounters. How does that work? Is Bigfoot a Nephilim? And in my opinion, he is.
Okay, or a descendant of the original Nephilim.
Look, it's very complex. We don't have all the answers. That's why we're going. That's why we're on the trail. That's why we're talking to as many people as we can.
The theme is track down all these unexplained types of beings and find out as much as you can that might allow you to form or complete theories about who they are and where they came from, how this became so diverse.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a hypothesis which we're working with, that these are the remnants of the Nephilim tribes, that they covered the earth, that they were here. We call it fallen angel technology, Nephilim architecture, and it's global, it's worldwide. We're headed up to an undisclosed location on the 23rd of April this month to film there. We've got a film, my film crew coming, and we'll fly drones and do all this other stuff and talk with an archaeologist. And, you know, we're there to talk with the people that know this site. And that'll be probably film number 4 and 5, because there's going to be plenty of so much information there. You just can't get it all in one hour show. So yeah. We've also been all over Europe. We're going back to Europe again this year. We haven't even done anything with that film yet. We got a lot of, I mean, I'm looking at my board over here, and we have like 10 titles on the board already, just 10 titles. And that's not without even going into the whole UFO thing. Which eventually
is going to be a video series, right?
Yeah, it is a video series. We have episode 1 and episode 2 are out. I'm actually in post-production on episode 3.
Okay, and what are 1 and 2 about?
Well, 1 is the mysterious mound builders, which I think you've seen.
Yeah.
And number 2 is mathematical mysteries of the mound builders. And no, 2...
That's the one I saw.
Okay. And remember when Todd Willis is standing in the moat of the Great Circle Mound? The Great Circle Mound is this huge circle in Ohio. It's 1,200 feet across. And in it, in the interior of that... And by the way, the mound goes up in some places over 20 feet. Okay? So right. In the interior of that circle is a moat. And by the way, that moat is about 8 feet deep, and it's basically dead level, 6 inches to a foot. So over 1,200 feet and 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago when the thing was built, just silt and stuff like that, essentially it's dead level. And that begs the question, how do you do that in the ancient world?
Well, not just the ancient world, but how do you prevent erosion between when it was built and now? Like, is there something resisting the inflow of mud flows and all that kind of stuff? Because if you went on as a contractor now,
right,
and somehow built a moat like that and then expected to come back in 2,000 years and find it, it wouldn't be visible.
I concur. And what's really interesting about this is the site, the fact that the mound is still intact. To the best of my knowledge, no one has taken core samples of these mounds to see the compaction rate.
There's got to be something beyond compaction. There's got to be a glue holding it together.
I agree.
Because no matter how compact you make it, as long as it's soil and not concrete, it's not going to be there in 100 years.
Here's something to think about. When they went to a place called the Graves Creek Mound, which we've been to several times, and that's in the new film, and we found the little lithograph of the giant skeleton, which isn't supposed to be there. We discovered it, right? Some person who was new at the museum made this little display and put it up. I don't think the director of the museum knew about it. Because there's no giant skeletons here. We walk out. That mound, they tunneled into it. And after a while, they realized that the dirt was so compact that they didn't need to shore the ceiling up. They didn't even do that. And that's a matter of historical record. That's how compact or glued together. It's a really good point.
Yeah, because the glue is a critical element. If you compact it and there's no cohesion between the particles, rainstorms are going to take care of it. You know, it's going to be gone.
I concur.
Really interesting. So besides the core samples testing the degree of compaction, they ought to try to find out what kind of glue is in there.
Yeah, the soil needs to be analyzed and see if there's unknown properties in it. Some of the dirt, let's say in the Great Circle Mound, some of it's taken from a mile away. And, you know, when I talked to an archaeologist about this, I'll never forget it. I said, well, how would you move the dirt from a mile away?
Right.
And she goes, well, they would use dog sleds. So,
of course, right. Yeah,
of course. So now it's like even crazier because there's so much dirt there. It's ridiculous. And these guys are smoking. They have a paradigm. There's no supernatural. We're saying something else is going on here.
Well, the other thing that they might think about, too, is where did the dirt come out of? Because there should be a big hole somewhere.
There should be burrow pits. And in some cases, there are. But in many cases, there are not. Also, if these mounds like Cahokia or Poverty Point, some of the larger ones, or Fort Ancient, and there's a clip we show. I think it's in the film. Not the second one, but the first one, we show a docent. This guy's going like, if you were to deconstruct all these mounds, which are about 3.5 miles of mounds, deconstruct them and fill up dump trucks end to end. And he goes like this, end to end, these dump trucks would be 200 miles of dump trucks. So once again, we're looking at, you know, clamshell hose. He believes clamshell hose, the scapula of a deer, and the scapula of a deer, we made a replica of it. Incredibly flimsy. It's going to break the moment it hits the first rock. The whole narrative, when you're actually out in the field with this stupid little flint hoe, it works well, but you're gathering the stuff up in your hand, and now it's 26 million buckets of earth for one mound.
You'd have to really clear your schedule for that. And they'd need a lot of people too, right?
Yeah, and guess what? There's no burials. Like in Egypt, you've got all these burials and there's thousands of people, yada yada yada. That's not what we have here. And in fact, we talked to the archaeologists at Poverty Point, and we said, well, how many families, how many villages were here? Well, he said about 10. And we said, well, about how many people in each village? About 25 in each village.
They're just really athletic people.
Oh, really athletic people. So the whole narrative just goes crash. It just crashes down when you begin to drill into it. But you go to any museum, any place, and you're going to hear Native Americans built this, and this is the party line. And I've got a 3:30, so I've got to wrap things up here.
Okay. The bottom line, I think, is you're doing pure basic research to expose hidden areas of history. And to try to come back to what really happened.
Bingo.
In all respects, right? And you're working against the theme in the outside world now where real information about almost anything is forbidden. violently suppressed.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I find the same thing in health and, you know, all these different fields. They don't want energy. Potential energy technology that we could be using right now is known and hidden. And we verified that. And all kinds of things, they don't really want us to discover anything. So,
I agree. Keep people sick, dumbed down.
Because
that's what our true urges are.
The infrastructure to have a different experience of life is already existing. You're just not supposed to know about it.
Yeah, or tap into it.
Yeah, pretty neat. Okay, well, thanks for the preview of what's coming up, too, in your next parts of this series. And
thanks, Richard.
If people want to stay aware of that and how close it is and what's coming next and what you're doing and new discoveries and things, how do they do that?
LAMarzulli.net, LAMarzulli.net, MARZULLI, LAMarzulli.net.
No dots or periods or anything, right?
No, oh, just LAMarzulli.net, and you're okay. Good to go.
Okay, sounds great. We'll stay in touch and look forward to hearing the next part.
Thank you.
Okay, you guys, there goes L.A. Marzulli. I'm really glad we got some time with him. He's a pretty busy guy. And thanks to Doug's help, he was able to spend some time with us. I think that, you know, he does seem like a modern-day Indiana Jones to me, Indiana Jones-type character, going out into places that you're not supposed to be able to get into and digging up information that you're not supposed to know. And there are people who definitely don't want him exposing all this kind of stuff, and he's doing it anyway and really doing some great work in looking for hidden pieces of history that would give us a more complete picture of what's going on here. And it certainly goes together with my experience that real information on health and energy and food and agriculture and science and so many things are forbidden, certainly all over the U.S. and much of the world right now. And they're suppressed with violence and intimidation and murder. And some people are exploring anyway, which they're not supposed to do. Eventually, all these things will come to light. But the process of digging them up can be a bit challenging. And certainly, real comprehensive view of what history actually is, what really happened on this planet, let alone anywhere else, is one of the big forbidden areas of knowledge. And it's great that there are people like L.A. Tracking it down. So if you want to stay in touch with him and his various video productions and other material that he's got available, remember going to his site, lamarzulli.net. That also connects to his blog site, which is separate, but you can get to everything from lamarzulli.net. So very inspiring to run into somebody with that spirit of exploration, no matter what they've find, even if it's in the forbidden realm, they just keep going. And really, if we want to become conscious ourselves of who we even are and what our potential is and our missing pieces of knowledge about our own present and past and what we can become, which is, I think, from what I've been able to tell, the most forbidden information and knowledge is who you are. And that with all of the different agendas that we see being carried out by the global rulers at this time in history, and all the things they're trying to suppress, all the awareness that they don't want us to have, and all the incredible taboos that they're willing to kill to preserve, the biggest one is who you are. And they want you to think that you're just this really limited being that can't do anything against all these giant movements that they've started to suppress everybody. Can't stop the coming of global government and tyranny. Can't stop the continued rollout of tyrannical drug medicine where you have no choice about what to do to take care of yourself. So many things that you're supposed to believe you can't stop. And I think what they don't want you to discover is that that's not exactly accurate, that you can not only stop but help turn around things to bring in a completely different experience of life on this planet. Something instead of hell on earth that the rulers are clearly pushing toward, bring in something like the opposite, not just for us, but for generations that need a place to have their lives later. We have that potential and more than we can really imagine right now. So don't necessarily buy all the limitation programming. In most cases, the opposite is what's true. Get your health back. Find out that this is why the forbidden health information is there, because if you become healthy, your physical body's working the way it's supposed to. Your brain becomes clear because your brain is part of your physical body, as you've no doubt realized. Get those things cleared up. Realize that the aging problem and the degeneration problem and the immunity problem, those are not normal problems. Those can all be eliminated by some exploration and learning that is still possible to do. And then from there, and even before you get to that point, start learning your forgotten normal state, which is really quite amazing. And it's the only thing that I know of that has a chance to turn the extermination program together around. That is what the global rulers are doing in the world right now. It's not just control, although that's certainly an essential part of it. It's not just population reduction, which is a step to the goal. It's complete extermination of life, including themselves. It's a suicide mission because they believe that they'll be rewarded on another dimension, and it's not going to be the way they think, but because they believe that, it's making a pretty big mess here for us, and we're walking around with the potential to turn the whole thing around. I just encourage you to do that. Don't be discouraged by anything. It's not necessary to feel bad if things on the outside are bad. That's a myth. You get to feel how you decide to feel by getting in touch with things that they don't want you to know about or to ever connect with. And if you want a support group to carry on that exploration with and take it much, much further, going over the actual forbidden information about health and related consciousness areas, things like that, check out planetaryhealingclub.com. I'll meet you there live once a week. It's pretty incredible. If you feel like you're really ready, because it takes some serious work, it's not a observational type activity. Anyway, that's available. We'll keep making the free videos during the week that you can check on all the major platforms like YouTube and Facebook and places like that until we get banned at some point. And then hopefully brighteon.com will still be a good alternative video site. brighteon.com by our friend Mike, who's banned everywhere, but he's doing some great work still, and you can still find him. Check out brighteon.com. What else do I want to tell you? Our main website, lostartsradio.com, has everything there. You can find out what we're doing and where to go. You can support us if you want to. If you've got money to do that, it'll keep us going and hopefully eventually build a physical school that we're wanting to do. But in the meantime, before that's possible, when there's not enough money, as long as the internet is still usable and they haven't totally shut that down, which I think they don't want to do because of the wonderful surveillance quality that it's got. They don't want to waste all that work. So as long as that's available, we'll keep working through the public shows and the private format at planetaryhealingclub.com, and look forward to seeing you there. See you next time.
Introducing Lost Arts Radio Live, our new Saturday late afternoon, early evening, 1 hour live stream show. This new show precedes our Planetary Healing Club, which starts at 9 p.m. Eastern and 6 p.m. Pacific. The Planetary Healing Club, which is not free and open to the public, but you can join for a minimum donation of just $10 a month. Our new live stream show, which is free, starts Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. Eastern and 4:30 Pacific. It can be accessed by going to lostartsradio.com/live. You can tune into our live stream from our Facebook page at facebook.com/lostartsradio, from our YouTube channel at youtube.com/lostartsradio, as well as both Periscope and Twitter at Lost Arts Radio. You can ask questions during the show by using the chat function on YouTube or make a comment on Facebook during the live stream. Once again, that's Lost Arts Radio Live, Saturdays at 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific. As of January 2018, the Saturday Live Call-In Show is now an interactive video platform called the Planetary Healing Club. The cost is just a $10 minimum monthly donation, automatically billed through your PayPal account. Sign up at lostartsradio.com/club. The Planetary Healing Club is every Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. You get your link to participate in the show upon signing up as a member. Those shows are also archived as well for club members. Listen to our new shows with guests every Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. All Sunday shows with guests have archives freely available on our website at lostartsradio.com. You can also find them at blogtalkradio.com/Lost Arts Radio, as well as our YouTube channel, youtube.com/C/Lost Arts Radio. Mixcloud at mixcloud.com/Lost Arts Radio. And finally, look us up under the podcast directory on iTunes. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Lost Arts Radio or on Twitter at Lost Arts Radio. Be sure to join the free Lost Arts Radio Facebook group as well. Just search for Lost Arts Radio Group within Facebook. You can also join our forum on our website if you want to interact with other listeners. We also have links to all of the great independent musicians whose music we feature each week on Lost Arts Radio. When you do your Amazon shopping, please use Amazon's Smile program at smile.amazon.com. And when you choose Lost Arts Research Institute in Sedona, Arizona as your charity, Amazon will donate 0.5% of whatever your order total is to Lost Arts Research Institute to help fund the building of the school and keep our radio show on the air. Please visit lostartsresearchinstitute.org for more information on the school we want to build. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter on our site under the radio show tab or right from the button on our Facebook page. Contact Richard at richard@lostartsradio.com or myself, Doug Diamond, at doug@lostartsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to Lost Arts Radio, and we'll see you again next week.
Leave your fear of the unknown and leave the planet you call home. Leave all the thoughts you think you know. It's time to let them go. Let it go. Extend your hands towards the stars and dip your toes in the valley marsh. Celestial storm in my backyard, and the universe explodes. Explodes. Let's see how fast our hearts can go. 'Cause you and I could be that comet in the sky. If we hold our breath, take a leap and close our eyes, we could fly. I believe if we try, we could fly. The time is now, the future's here. We'll watch our dark days disappear. I see the water running clear. Plans of fate are washed away. And stardust crystal caves, sparkling towers, cityscapes. Is this a dream or are we awake? Hand in hand through outer space. Time stands still for us today. 'Cause you and I could be that comet in the sky. If we hold our breath, take a leap and close our eyes, we could fly. I believe if we try, we could fly. Like the heroes in the sky, we could fly. Cause you and I could be that comet in the sky. If we hold our breath, take a leap and close our eyes, we could fly. I believe.
could fly like the heroes in the sky. We could fly. You and I could be the comet in the sky. If we hold our breath, take a leap and close our eyes, we could fly. I believe if we try, we could fly. Fly, we could fly.